everyone. I'm Katie O'Connor, Director of Policy Development and Programming at the American Constitution Society. And thank you so much for joining us for today's briefing call on Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. I have just a few housekeeping items before we get to the substance of the conversation. First, please note that today's call is being recorded, and we'll be providing a link to the recording after the call. Second, 1/2 hour of California CLE credit is available for this call. If you're interested in getting that credit, please email Matt Scoble at mscoble@acslaw.org. Finally, we have reserved some time at the end of the call for Q&A, and you'll be given instructions for asking questions at that time. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not already a formal part of our network, I encourage you to join. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's speakers. Melissa Murray is a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. She's a graduate of the University of Virginia and Yale Law School and a former clerk to Sonia Sotomayor, then of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Her research focuses on the roles that criminal law and family law play in articulating the legal parameters of intimate life and encompasses such topics as the legal regulation of sex and sexuality, the marriage equality debate, and reproductive rights and justice. Most recently, she co-authored with Kristen Luker Cases on Reproductive Rights and Justice, the first legal casebook on reproductive rights and justice. Julie Rickelman is the litigation director at the Center for Reproductive Rights and one of the amazing attorneys representing Whole Woman's Health in this case. She first worked at the center from 1990 to 1991 as a Blackman Fellow, and before returning to the center in 2011 as senior staff attorney, Julie was vice president of litigation at NBC Universal. In 2012, she was appointed as the center's litigation director. Julie clerked for Morton Greenberg of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit and Dana A. Fabe of the Alaska Supreme Court. In 2004, she won the National Law Journal Pro Bono Award. She graduated with honors from Harvard Law School. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Melissa.
Hi. I just wanted to begin the call by sort of setting up some of the legal standards or elucidating some of the legal standards that would help us think about what's going on in Whole Woman's Health. As you know, Whole Woman's Health is the first case since Casey to really think about the undue burden standard. And so in order to sort of think about what that means, I wanted to go back to Casey, which is a 1992 case that the court took up. There, the court was sort of facing a transformed bench, Justice Marshall and Justice Brennan, who had been among the majority in Roe, were no longer on the court and instead had been replaced by a number of other justices, including Clarence Thomas, Sandra Day O'Connor, and Anthony Kennedy. And so the question in Casey was whether or not Roe, which had been seen as imperiled for a number of years, would survive the court's decision in Casey. And there was every indication after oral argument that Roe would fall in the court's decision in Casey. Surprisingly, the Casey plurality did not completely dismantle Roe, although it did dismantle Roe's trimester framework for determining when an abortion would be legal, and instead sort of replaced it with a legal time frame that was associated with fetal viability. It also dismantled the standard of review in Roe, which had been strict scrutiny, and instead substituted for it this idea of an undue burden. And under the undue burden standard that Casey prescribes, the regulation of a pre-viability abortion is constitutional if the law satisfies two conditions. One, it doesn't have the purpose or effect of placing a substantial obstacle in the path of a woman seeking an abortion of a non-viable fetus. And two, it is reasonably related to or designed to further a legitimate state interest. Interestingly, the Casey plurality, although it articulated this framework, didn't give it a lot of flesh. So, you know, there are a number of provisions that are challenged in Casey. Some of them are upheld, some of them fall. But the whole idea of the standard, the teeth of the standard is really unclear. And I think that's really what we want to focus on as you think about Whole Women's Health. This really will be the case, I think, that give some flesh and some color to what this undue burden standard means on the ground. Julie will go into the facts of the case and sort of the legal arguments in the case in more detail, but I just wanted to sort of call attention to some of the history of this. Whole Women's Health is a challenge to a series of Texas statutes, HB 2, that impose various restrictions on abortion providers operating in the state of Texas. The first is to require abortion providers to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of the abortion clinic or center for provision. The other would require abortion clinics to be outfitted as ambulatory surgical centers, so basically mini hospitals that function in all respects in the manner of hospitals, including with the width for hallways and things of that nature. And critics of these kinds of regulations have argued that they are not intended to foster women's health, as the state claims, but rather that they're intended to make the provision of abortion services unduly cost prohibitive and basically to force abortion providers out of business. You will remember HB 2 from Wendy Davis, who was the Texas state legislator who famously attempted to filibuster the law on the floor of the Texas State House in her pink sneakers. That filibuster obviously was unsuccessful. The bill was passed and ultimately signed into law by Governor Rick Perry. And from there, it's had, as Julie will discuss, startling effects on the availability of abortion provision in the state of Texas. So with that, I'll turn it over to Julie, who will continue.
Thanks, Melissa. So let me just build a little bit on what Melissa has started to talk about in terms of what this case really means, what Whole Women's Health is really going to mean for women in the country. And that really involves thinking about the landscape of abortion restrictions around the country today. So the two requirements that we're challenging in the Texas case, which Melissa described, are TRAP laws, which stands for Targeted Regulation of Abortion Providers. These are laws that single out medical practices that provide abortion services for unique regulation that's different and more burdensome than regulation imposed on similar medical practices. TRAP laws have been around for decades, but they have become increasingly burdensome in the past 5 years. And this recent wave of TRAP laws is threatening to shutter abortion clinics all over the country by imposing requirements that do nothing to improve women's health, but that clinics simply cannot meet. And major medical groups like the AMA and ACOG have come out opposing many of these requirements precisely because they don't help women's health. These requirements include admitting privileges for physicians performing abortions, as Melissa mentioned, and ASC-type requirements, which include a variety of different requirements, including physical infrastructure requirements, things like the size of janitor closets. And just to give you a sense of what this really means for women, there are numerous states where abortion clinics are open today only because of court orders obtained in litigation against TRAP laws. For example, in Mississippi, there's only one abortion clinic left in the state, and it's open today because of a court order blocking an admitting privileges requirement passed a few years ago. In Louisiana, there are 5 clinics in the state, and most of them would be closed but for a court order blocking that state's admitting privileges requirement. Similarly, in Alabama, there are 5 abortion clinics left, and most would be closed but for a court order blocking several TRAP laws that have been passed in that state. As you can see, many of the most extreme TRAP laws have been passed in states in the South, leaving women in that geographic region at particular risk of losing access to safe medical abortion. But women in many states around the country are also affected by TRAP laws, and that includes states in the Midwest, in the Northeast. It is not a problem that is limited to the South only. So let me turn now to the details of the Texas case. As Melissa mentioned, the Whole Women's Health case involves 2 requirements in Texas House Bill 2, which was enacted in 2013, the admitting privileges requirement and the ASC requirement. The center filed the case in April of 2014, and it went to trial a few months later in August in Austin in front of the federal district court judge there. Judge Yackel, who was our judge in the case, heard testimony from 19 live witnesses over the course of a week-long trial. And following that trial, Judge Yackel found that both the admitting privileges requirement and the AAC requirement are unconstitutional, and he blocked them from being enforced statewide. In his opinion, he said that these two requirements would do nothing to help women's health, and that by drastically reducing access to legal abortion in the state, they would actually harm women. Here are some of the key findings that he made after hearing all of the evidence at the trial. He found that abortion in Texas was extremely safe before HB2, that abortion is actually much safer in terms of minor and serious complications than many common medical procedures not subject to such intense regulation and scrutiny by Texas. He also found that women will not obtain better care at an ambulatory surgical center as compared to a standard abortion clinic, that many of the building standards mandated by HB2 have such a tangential relationship to patient safety in the context of abortion as to be nearly arbitrary. He said that the justifications offered by the state for the admitting privileges requirement were not credible, and that finally, the health risks for women associated with increased delays in seeking early abortion care and increases in self-induced abortions in the state would almost certainly cancel out any potential health benefits of these two requirements. Despite the strong opinion from Judge Yackel, after the trial, we had to battle to keep the injunctions in place and the clinics in Texas open. And one of the things that you may not know about this case is that the Supreme Court has already stepped in twice. In October of 2014, a few months after the trial, the Fifth Circuit lifted the injunctions in the case on an emergency basis. This allowed both of the requirements to be fully implemented, and the number of clinics in the state of Texas dropped overnight from about 20 to 7. We went to the Supreme Court at that point and asked it to step in, and it did, and it issued an order that allowed more than a dozen clinics to reopen later that month in October. The case then proceeded at the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit issued its final order in June of 2015. In that order, it largely ruled against us, except for some limited relief for the Whole Women's Health Clinic in McAllen. And again, we had to go back to the Supreme Court to keep clinics open while we petitioned for cert. So last summer, we asked the Supreme Court to step in, and it did, and issued another order in our favor that allowed all of the clinics that were open before the Fifth Circuit's decision to stay open while the Supreme Court resolves this case. So as we approach the Supreme Court oral argument on March 2nd, this is essentially the state of the law in Texas. The ASC requirement is blocked statewide, and the admitting privileges requirement is blocked for only two clinics in the state, one in McAllen and one in El Paso, leaving about 19 facilities open in the state. So let me turn now to the legal arguments in the case. As Melissa mentioned, this case revolves around the meaning of the undue burden standard and how it should be applied to a law that is purportedly designed to promote women's health. In front of the Supreme Court, we're making several key legal arguments. First, that four decades of unbroken Supreme Court precedent provide that the decision to end a pregnancy is a fundamental right that is central to women's liberty, autonomy, and dignity. Second, when applying the undue burden standard, courts must evaluate whether laws that restrict abortion supposedly to promote women's health actually promote women's health. In other words, laws that restrict abortion based on a pretext cannot be allowed to stand under the Constitution. Third, the Texas requirements fail the undue burden standard when understood correctly because the evidence presented at trial showed that these requirements would not promote women's health, but would instead threaten their health by drastically reducing access throughout the state to safe and legal abortion. And fourth, that both the purpose and the effect of these requirements is to place substantial obstacles in the paths of women seeking abortion services in Texas, which is the crux of the undue burden standard, as Melissa described. So let me just take a few minutes now to make clear the impact of these requirements on Texas women in particular. Before HB2 was enacted, there were more than 40 medical facilities in Texas that provided abortion services. They were spread throughout the state in a variety of geographic areas. Today, because of the admitting privileges requirement, that number has dwindled to 19. If the Supreme Court rules in favor of Texas, that number would fall to 10 or fewer, and that would amount to a 75% reduction approximately in the number of facilities providing abortions in the state of Texas. Except for the clinic in McAllen, which, as I mentioned, has only limited relief from the requirements, all of the remaining clinics open in the state of Texas would be clustered in just four major metropolitan areas: Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston-Austin, and San Antonio. And it's important to remember, of course, that Texas is the second largest state in the country by both population and area, and that it is home to nearly 5.4 million women of reproductive age. Thanks.
Okay, I think with that, we're ready to take some questions. Does that sound right?
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. We will pause for just a moment for the Q&A roster.
As we wait for questions in the queue, Julie, I did have one question for you. I know that your opponents have argued that ambulatory surgical center requirements are placed on other similar procedures or medical centers. So I'm wondering what similar medical centers are and are not required to be outfitted as ASCs?
The arguments by the other side are just wrong, Katie. So there in Texas, there is no other type of medical procedure that is required to be done in an ASC other than abortion.
That's an easy answer. Thank you.
Sure.
At this time, there are no questions in queue.
Okay, let's give it one more minute and see if any questions come up.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone who has a question to press star, then one on your telephone keypad. We will pause for just a moment for the Q&A roster. Your first question comes from the line of Dawn Johnson.
Hi, thanks for that briefing. I actually had to join a couple minutes late, so I hope you didn't talk about this already, but I wondered if you could talk about what Justice Scalia's death means for the case, if the vacancy isn't filled.
Julie, do you want to take that since you all have talked about that a little bit?
Sure. I think that it's probably too hard to speculate right now exactly what it will mean. It seems that historically cases have sometimes been re-argued in these situations and sometimes they haven't. So, for instance, if the case were decided 4-4, that would mean in this circumstance that the decision of the Fifth Circuit were affirmed, which would, of course, mean that these particular regulations are allowed to go into effect for access in Texas. And so the question is whether or not the court would do that or whether it would re-argue in those circumstances. If the decision came out 5-3, then there may not be a reason for the court to re-argue. So again, historically, it seems like the court has handled this in different ways, and it's just too hard to tell right now what it will decide to do.
Your next question comes from the line of Shakira Sanders.
Hi, thank you again so much for the briefing. I had to step out for about 5 minutes. I wondered how does Gonzalez versus Carhart play into this, since that case was the one that actually had the majority for the Casey viability framework.
Julie, do you want me to take it, or do you want to take it?
Sure. Go ahead, Melissa.
Okay. So Gonzalez, I think, is slightly different. You know, there the court was considering the constitutionality of the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act, which is a congressional ban, a congressional law, not a state-level law. Again, the court held it didn't impose an undue burden on the right of women to obtain an abortion. But again, I think it's slightly different than what you're seeing here. I mean, like, the court sort of was focusing on the fact that, you know, this seemed reasonable in light of women's health. It was post-viability. Like, so this law, it seems, focuses on pre-viability impositions on the right. So I think there's something different that we ought to be attentive to in the whole women's health context versus Gonzalez versus Carhart. I think one thing that does sort of shape all of it is the fact that Justice Kennedy, who wrote for the majority in Gonzalez, seems to have sort of clear ideas about what the abortion right might mean for women and the sort of skepticism that women understand what they are doing when they choose to have an abortion, and some sense that women will come to regret the decision. So I think one of the ways in which it will be interesting to see how this plays out is that whether or not that kind of thinking will play a role in his understanding of this particular case.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jacob Lillian.
Hello. Something that you mentioned briefly is the danger that is posed by laws like this when women can't get access to abortions. And I was wondering, I mean, it certainly seems intuitive to me that there would be a rise in women not being able to get abortions and resorting to other, not being able to get safe legal abortions and resorting to other methods. But I'm wondering if you actually have data on that.
Sure. Do you want me to take that, Katie?
Yeah, please.
There is data on that from several things that have happened in the past, actually including in Texas. So a number of years ago, Texas passed a law requiring that all abortions after 15 weeks be done in ambulatory surgical centers. So that law has already been on the books, meaning that this set of requirements is really about abortions done in the first 15 weeks, early abortions. So after that law went into effect, requiring all abortions after 15 weeks to be done in ASCs, there was a decrease in the number of abortions after that period of time. And that decrease has never changed. So in essence, it was a permanent decrease. And so data like that exists showing that when access to abortion is reduced, it does cut down on the number of abortions in the state, while you may see increases in women going out of state, or as Judge Jekyll mentioned, increases potentially in self-induced abortions, which can be less safe for women than seeking them from facilities that provide abortion services.
There are no further questions in queue.
Great. Well, thank you all, participants. Melissa or Julie, do you have any last words? Okay. Well, then I just want to thank you both and thank all of the participants for joining us on today's call, and have a great day, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you.